Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Ellick Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs, Murders, Money, and Mystery. I'm Ann Emerson, and I'm joined with our exclusive legal analyst, former South Carolina Attorney General Charlie Condon, and our executive producer, Drew Tripp. Thank you for joining us. We are discussing in what's about to occur over the next couple of weeks, which is the new filings that have come through as we head toward this evidentiary hearing based on the jury tampering allegations involving Colleton County Clerk Becky Hill. These are allegations and what is going to happen with this retrial hearing. Now, what we know right now is that both the defense and the state have had an opportunity to file their pretrial briefs. We have a status conference hearing coming up on January 16th. Just a couple of weeks away. And then, of course, the actual retrial hearing has been scheduled by the Supreme Court Justice Jean Toll, and that is supposed to be happening January 29th through the 31st. So right now we have some big legal questions to get answered today. And I'm just going to kick it off with the first thing that, you know, Drew and I have been going over all of this information. I know that you have been looking over these briefs as well, Charlie. And one thing that really stood out to us was a serious discrepancy between these two briefs in what the defense believes is the basis of this evidentiary hearing and these jury tampering allegations and what the state is saying. And to the point that the state is still arguing, why are we having this evidentiary hearing?
So really set the table, I think, for how important, contentious probably is not the right word, but how high the stakes are coming up as we go into this hearing. That's just my takeaway, because we've got some, again, to Ann's point, we've got some really serious, heavy-duty legal issues to work out, do we not, Charlie?
I think it's unprecedented. I think this is something that our Supreme Court at some point is going to review what the standard is in this situation. And to talk about the opposing views, the state wants it to be State versus Green. That's their case, in which the there's basically sort of a harmless error analysis by the court there that it was a bailiff who was asked about what happens if we're deadlocked, and he talked about what it's called an Allen charge, called a dynamite charge. If you'll get one of those, and that will be the judge's charge to you. Shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. Court said harmless error, didn't affect the verdict. That's the state's position. The defense's position, which I must say, if you, not to predict anything here, because this been unpredictable in the Murdoch case, but it does seem as if what they're saying applies more readily to our current situation, which is State versus Cameron. In State versus Cameron, old statute for entering a bank with intent to steal, the jury could decide guilty, not guilty. If guilty, do you give mercy or not mercy? And if you give mercy, It's less than the maximum sentence, which I think, as I recall, was life. Very important. So the bailiff entered the fray on that. What happens? Tell me about this. The juror asked, and the bailiff opined on it, and the court ruled that that entered the sanctity of the jury. They could have been confused. New trial. So what standard does Justice Toll apply? That will be the key, and I suspect she may talk about that at the first meeting that we have on the 16th. She may not. She may hold back on that. But both sides are fighting tooth and nail, because I do think that the standard potentially will dictate the result.
So just to be clear, what we're looking at is the defense is saying that that all that was necessary, and correct me anywhere along this, all that was necessary was this improper contact by this court official, Clark Hill, allegedly to the jury, which they're saying these jury tampering allegations that she had referred to body language, according to the sworn affidavit from a juror. So we're looking at this sort of improper contact. They're saying that's all you need, right? That's what Cameron is.
Well, because the kind of contact from the elected court official, the clerk, enters into the sanctity of the jury. You don't have to show that it would change the verdict. You have to show that the contact occurred and it was in this really important sanctity of jury type language that the State versus Cameron used. And I must say, having read these cases, it's confusing. You can pick out little snippets here and there, and both sides have done that, I think, very well. And in picking out the different reasoning there, I think Justice Toll has a really important job here on deciding, like, what standard am I going to apply? I suspect, knowing her, she's going to announce that at some point, I'm going to apply this standard after hearing arguments. But it's the key moment, because I do think if it's under the stricter Cameron standard, as I call it, if you think about what happened here, it just seems like, gosh, if they can prove that the elected clerk of court started to give this sort of commentary to jurors before they deliberated, it does seem like it enters into the sanctity of our system. On the other hand, in the state's position, wait a minute. We've got so much evidence against this dude. It didn't take them very long to reach a verdict. All the jurors will say that it didn't impact them at all. So State versus Green, this is not that big a deal. It's not good. We're not here to defend Becky Hill, but you should uphold this verdict, because all of them say that they would reach the same verdict and the activity of the clerk didn't affect me. So which way do you go?
So that's it. So that's the state is saying there's two layers here that Justice Toll's going to have to, like, kind of sift through. So their two layers, as opposed to the defense, is one layer. Their two layers is improper contact, and did it affect or prejudice this verdict?
Yeah. And one thing, I was fascinated. Apparently there had been some real discussions at the conference that they had by telephone, because it looks like a lot of the ground rules were set with this discovery business going back, meaning what information is going to be shared. And it seemed like where they're headed is that Judge Newman may testify in camera, jurors in camera, by the way, that means in private, in the chambers. Press won't be there. I think in camera from Latin translates in chambers. So it's in chambers with the judge. It's all private. And they're setting that up. Both sides seem to be agreeable to that if we go that far. The state doesn't want to, but I think we're headed that way. But what they definitely want to do, the defense does, they want to put Clerk Hill front and center. And they want to be able to go through all of the attacks possible on her credibility, which unfortunately there are many now. So that they're going to say that she's not believable and juror 630 is. And if you look at what she said to 630 as the juror testifies to, that gets into the Cameron territory. So what Justice Toll may well do is let the fray occur, let it all, see how it shifts out, see how it strikes her, and then maybe have language as to the standard. I don't know how she may handle it, but that would be another approach, to wait till all of it and then announce her decision. Probably, knowing her, it's probably not going to be announced the day of. It'll probably be a written order released a week or two later.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting. I didn't even think about that. Of course, we're still waiting for this verdict to come out again or something. Mm-hmm. And why would she do that when she can take as much time as she wants to think about that?
That's kind of the point, and to what Charlie was just referencing, that's kind of the point I want to take off with. It is, we're... just slightly ahead of our skis a little bit on a couple of issues, which is, one, the states argue, it comes down to this, proving that there was actual improper contact. And I think from the defense's position, from Murdoch's position, they are gung-ho, adamant, fully bought in, yes, there was improper contact. And the state is still trying to push the brakes on this a little bit and raise questions. And the state is saying in its filing this week, in its brief this week, essentially that you need to prove that this actually occurred, because a lot of what they're still banking on hearsay and, you know, credibility of the people Murdoch spoke to and the jurors that they spoke to, and pointing out things like, as you mentioned, Charlie, that none of the jurors polled, either by SLED for the state or by the defense counsel, none so far have actually said that right. anything Becky Hill did impacted the way that they voted, essentially, impacted their verdict, whether or not they found Murdoch guilty. So to dive into that, you still have the state saying that they are not convinced there was actually any improper contact, and Murdoch saying, of course there was. Like, we'll just listen to it. And that comes again to, this is us trying to weed through a lot of the, again, cut through a lot of the noise as far as that goes, to what has actually been alleged based on, what are the accusations that have any seeming meat to them? And we've gone over this plenty of times, but that it seems to be the commentary that Becky is accused of making regarding paying close attention to Murdoch and potentially watching his body language. Mm. So, and I do need to make a quick self-correction here. I believe in a few prior episodes I've said that there were three additional jurors that the state itself interviewed that corroborated what Juror 630 told the defense, and that was mistaken. There were two additional jurors who specifically mentioned, if you go and look at the state's filing from back in, it's either late October or November, but the state's long, in-depth filing they made opposing the motion for a retrial hearing in the first place, they had this table and a graph in there, and they had their questions. Did Becky Hill say anything to you about evidence? Did you see Becky having any one-on-one conversations with an individual juror? And for the 10 jurors that the state interviewed, juror 630 excluded, and another juror, I can't remember the number, was not also unavailable for the state to interview in that, but they interviewed the 10 remaining jurors who actually deliberated on the verdict. And two of them said, no, Becky didn't comment on the evidence, but I do remember her saying something about body language or watch his movements, which speaks mm-hmm. directly to what juror 630 said, right? So you have a cohesion there between three jurors, two interviewed by the state, one interviewed by Murdoch and company. And then you had a fourth saying, no, I don't remember that, but she just told us generally to pay attention. And the one of those two who said they recalled body language commentary said the same thing. Yeah, she told us generally just to kind of pay attention. And then there was a fourth who said, again, pay attention. But they specifically said that they did not hear any body language comments, but just more of a general pay attention. Mm. So that seems to be, we're kind of editorializing a little bit to cut through what the state, what the defense is certainly going to try to do is all this other stuff that they put out there mm-hmm. about potential improper contact that is a little, it just kind of, in my opinion, dubious, very hard to prove. And what, like, it speaks more to what you got into a moment ago, Charlie, about they want to impeach Becky Hill. Just in general, to rake up all the mud.
Yeah, they've said. Yeah, that's a good point, because in looking at the defense brief, obviously juror 630 is the centerpiece of their position. They feel like they've got that's going to be proven. Mm-hmm. Becky has at least to some degree denied it in an affidavit. So what they've set up, I think, quite nicely in their brief, we'll see if Justice Toll goes along with it, is, all right, 6:30 comes forward in camera, in private. That juror says whatever is going to be said. And, all right, only way to disprove that or say it didn't happen is Becky Hill. And they've asked that the court put her front and center, not in camera, meaning not in private, mm-hmm. but in public.
Right.
And they believe that all of the misdeeds that she's been accused of since the trial go to her credibility. And they should be allowed to go into that completely because her credibility is the key issue at this evidentiary hearing. I think they have the winning argument there. So I think Clerk Hill is just, wow, talk about being on the hot seat. And so I do think she's got some Fifth Amendment issues she needs to address with her attorney.
Well, she's just to be clear about what these other charges are looking like, we have a public corruption investigation into Hill over the stolen money, claims of stolen money. You've got illegally sold access to the courthouse allegations. You have conspiracy with her son to conduct illegal wiretap allegations and plagiarism charges in her memoir in the trial. Those were just some of the things that I was listing out that you can read more about from all of the writing that we have online from Drew's articles from abcnews4.com. You know, these are just some of the allegations, charges. None of it's been proven in a court of law. These are things that speak to Hill's credibility. But to that point, these are not things, all of that I was just talking about, these are coming out of ethics complaints that have not been fully vetted. They're coming out of now the plagiarism charges she actually came forward and
admitted.
So that's different.
Right, yeah.
But that's not illegal. Right.
No,
that's
but that's credibility.
But it goes to towards
her honesty,
your credibility.
Dishonesty. And I do think that, to think about since the verdict until now, how many months has it been? Not many.
Nine.
Yeah.
And so in this short, within a year, you've got all these things swirling around about her that do go to, I think, credibility issues. Is she to be believed when she says she didn't do it? And so I do think it's very likely Justice Toll will let them go into it to a large degree. They may be forced to sort of what I call take the answer under evidentiary rules. If she denies it, they may not be able to go into proving that she did in fact do it through these collateral matters because it gets too far afield. I think she may have the ability to limit it that way. But I think we're looking at a pretty tough day for her if she testifies.
Well, you know what that reminds me of is the trial within the trial that we dealt with Alec Murdoch.
No question.
Just, you know, we went through this entire thing with Judge Newman was the financials.
No question.
And should the financials be included? And was that, did that speak to the credibility of Alec Murdoch? And here we are in another situation with Becky Hill, and now we're looking at all these claims that have not been proven.
Right.
They have not gone up, you know, she's not been charged with these crimes.
Yeah, right.
It's just it's fascinating that now we're looking at this trial, within a hearing, within a hearing.
I know, and if you're representing Becky Hill, she's got, I think, Justin Bamberg representing, also somebody, a criminal defense lawyer out of Columbia, I believe, representing.
Will Lewis, I believe is his name.
Yeah, and so how do you advise her?
Well,
does
and
she try and take
and another lawyer that's overseeing her ethics complaints as
mm-hmm.
well.
Yeah, and does she try to take the Fifth Amendment? They take the position she can't take it. I believe that she will be able to if she wants to, and that may be a wise move for her at this point.
What does constitute taking the Fifth Amendment? When can you say no? Is there a way to literally force a person to speak in court?
If you give them immunity. In other words, if you have the ability to say you're not going to be prosecuted for this, the challenge is going to be, all right, there are potential state law violations and maybe potential federal law violations. I don't know off the top of my head what those might be. So you'd have to get agreements from both. But, you know, she that's a tough call, I would think. Because if she does take it, I think juror 630 wins the day. And does the state really want her to do that, right? I mean, to take the Fifth. I'm sure they're working with her in some degree because it's a key witness for the state. So I'm sure there's lots of communications going on that would be fascinating as to what she can and can't testify to or will testify to when the hearing comes up. This is really from a legal standpoint. There's so many important, fascinating legal issues and questions that are going to be addressed as we go through this. And we probably won't hear the end of it relative to how it all turns out, because both sides, whether it can be an interlocutory appeal, meaning appeal right away, or they have to wait until there's a new trial and verdict, I don't know. I think they're allowed to do it interlocutory. I'd have to look that up. But there's, as we all have talked about here before, I do think that as we've come to this, this is a central key part of the Murdoch saga. Does the verdict hold? And if it doesn't hold, I think the state has some real challenges on a retrial.
I'd really like to talk a little bit about Becky Hill's character. We need to kind of figure out what is going to be allowed by Justice Toll to talk about. You know, so much has happened, and they even bring it up in the brief, don't they, Charlie? They
Yeah, let me read this, because this is their position from the defense. Anything that impeaches Ms. Hill is relevant. And the state's rhetoric about Ms. Hill being a dedicated public servant, unfairly maligned, has not aged well in the 2 months since the state filed its response, to put it mildly. Ms. Hill is alleged to have stolen money, illegally sold access to the courthouse, conspired with her son to conduct illegal wiretaps, and even had her book removed from publication because of her plagiarism. It's a lot.
It's a lot, and it has not even been a year since this verdict came down, as you said. I mean, this is a lot.
And Charlie, something you said a moment ago, when we start talking about credibility, you said, I think juror 630 might win the day there based on what's there so far. And in my mind, where I went was, okay, well, how can the state rebut that? How can they impugn juror 630's character? And so far, they haven't tried to. All they've done, it really is say, we think there's a good chance that maybe juror 630 and I guess they would have to apply the same standard to the ones that SLED interviewed, the two additional jurors who SLED interviewed, who said they thought they also remembered stuff about watch the body language, don't be, well, they didn't. Juror 630 right. is one of the ones who said don't be, she recalls hearing don't be fooled. Well, if we're going to try and take that, and if we're going to do anything at all to try and get into the credibility of 630, that opens up a new can of worms, because as the state pointed out in its brief this week, and this has been out there previously, there is a landlord-tenant relationship between juror 630, who, as we've kind of described it, the star witness for the defense. Yeah. There's the egg lady, the so-called egg lady juror 785, who was removed from the jury at the 11th hour, right before they were closing arguments and going into deliberations. Juror 785 was removed. Juror 785 was the landlord to juror 630. And there's, so that immediately, with the state pointing that out, that suggests, oh, maybe there's some sort of, like, maybe there's a motivation there with juror 630 to look out for her landlord. Or, I mean, could she, what if she doesn't stick up for her landlord? And does that mean, you can do all sorts of speculating on what that means and what that relationship and why she would be motivated to say what she said in support of the really, really salacious and scandalous things that juror 785 said, which gets into the next point. The state, while mentioning juror 785 and juror 630's relationship, the state at the same time has moved to strike, suppress anything related to juror 785 and the Facebook controversy, the apparently made up drama over somebody who was mistakenly identified as the juror's ex-spouse. And that gets into a whole other issue that we've got to talk about, is like how restrictive the state wants this hearing to be, while still out of one side of their mouth saying there shouldn't be a hearing at all because the defense hasn't failed to prove that there was actually right. improper contact, mm-hmm. Which again, we covered that a little bit. That's kind of a moot point. This ship has sailed. There's going to be a hearing. But the whole restriction of the scope and the limitation of the questioning, that's another interesting one. And then,
well, they're saying they only want two questions, right?
Right. Exactly.
They want to know, was your verdict guilty, mm-hmm. and to the jurors, and was the verdict based on the evidence, what you heard in court, you know, what happened in right. this trial. as opposed to anything, I think basically implying that, was there anything else that could have given you that verdict?
Right, exactly.
So those are the only two questions that the state wants, right? Mm-hmm.
But one and two, they proposed that.
Exactly.
What are the chances that's the grain standard.
I think if, I suspect what Justice Toll will do is, instead of buying into that right away, because that presupposes she's applying this green standard, just very limited, hey, did it affect your verdict or not, basically. My suspicions are, given the fact that we have 3 days, right, mm-hmm. with a court order and how the press is to be aligned and pool, and I don't believe you do all that unless you intend to hear lots of witnesses, wouldn't you think? Mm-hmm.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Which means we could be sitting in an empty courtroom a lot of the time. Huh?
I think a lot of we will. I think a lot of times they'll be back in chambers with these jurors and potentially Judge Newman. We might see him come in
and
there.
What are they going to ask Judge Newman?
I'm fascinated by that too. Yeah.
What is the point of that?
I thought that was interesting because he did obviously have lots of interplay with the clerk. Mm-hmm. Lots. And that's typical. Nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think the egg lady information that we talked about, I think that's probably not going to be that relevant in this. To me, that's a bit far afield. So whether or not he gets into or is questioned as to anything relative to improper juror conduct, I don't know. That was fine. But it's clear in their brief that he may be a witness.
Well, and the thing I wonder about, too, is this Justice Toll's opportunity here to hear the jurors firsthand, look them in the eye, let them use their voices? Because, you know, we all know that when you text somebody or email somebody, it feels very different than when you actually discuss it.
Yeah, one thing I did think about this, too, is if you start thinking about what they're accusing Clerk Hill of doing, it would be important for me to have the context of that. Did she go walking in there at a key moment during the trial? Because they do want to have the transcript as part of the exhibits here. And so when did she have to talk about watch the body language? Mm-hmm. And how did she do that? I mean, we were all there.
Right.
And so to go back to that room, did she just march back in there and walk in there? And that, to me, is really important, the actual setting. That's a really good point.
And that again, the state continues to try to make that point, is that they have produced the sworn statements of 10 of the 12 deliberating jurors, 8 of whom are adamant that, it's not even 8, it's all 10 that they talked to said, no, she didn't say anything about the evidence.
Right.
She didn't say anything to us about evidence.
Good point.
She didn't comment on the evidence. But what gets tricky there is potential comments about telling them a specific thing to look out for, like body language, when it does align so closely with what the state was arguing in open court. And this Creighton Waters is, and he's making the points in these briefs. He's like, yeah, that's something I said. And one of the actual jurors that they interviewed said, yeah, Creighton Waters said that. She didn't say that. Becky didn't say that to us. Creighton said body language, pay attention to his movements, watch him closely. It's this whole nexus of, okay, are they misremembering, or are they misattributing that? But and then when you have two additional jurors who feel like, no, I remember something about Becky saying that.
Yeah.
Is it now that it just
passing
makes the
comment, or was it purposeful?
Well, and
is
that's
it so accidental.
It's the contextual nature of this, right? So maybe that's mm-hmm. what we're getting to the heart of, is that these jurors are going to get an opportunity to say, wait a minute, I know that's what they wrote down in the SLED interview, but this is what I want to explain. Like, she walked in after, you know, or however they want to explain it. I think that's going to be super important for this part of the hearing. And, of course, we're all going to be in the dark, aren't we, for a little while.
Yeah. Didn't you think the other curious thing about the defense filing about Becky sending emails to the prosecutor? Did you catch that part?
Yeah.
And to law enforcement.
Yeah, commenting on witnesses.
Right, defense witnesses. Is that right?
That seems highly unusual. I don't. Yeah. I've just. That's just. You just not something that's not done, right? I mean. So,
why would she do that?
Who knows? I mean, other than a gross level of comfort that was inappropriate. It'd be one thing if she was sending it to everyone, right? If she got an email about a concern, something going on in the courtroom, and she sent it to the judge, she sent it to the state, she sent it to the prosecution. Hey, I got this. Wanted to make sure all of you were aware in case it was something that you feel like needs to be addressed. But, and this goes back to the trove of emails. If you've not been keeping up with that, the FOIA release that we got over the holidays. Some of which were also exemplified in there. Becky would receive emails, and she would forward them. One of them was commenting on the defense's expert witness. It was a weapons expert. That's one I specifically remember reading from the email for the FOIA emails from Colleton County. A weapons expert, a military veteran, was like, that guy that the defense put on the stand, he's glossing over. He's not, you know. And then she forwards that to the prosecution.
To Creighton Waters' email address during the trial.
Yes.
It sounds like she's just really taking sides, right? I mean,
yeah, it does.
Supposed to do that,
and that gets. They're gonna have to litigate all that, and I think it really speaks to. It comes back to one of the central issues that is still at play, which is between the state and the defense. The defense is arguing, based on one of the standards. I'm not sure if it was. I believe it was Rimmer. That they were the Rimmer case. They were arguing the fact that a court official had any contact whatsoever, and throw out whether or not because we're going to litigate that too. We're gonna try to get to the bottom of that in court. Did she have improper contact with the jury outside of the scope of her official duties as the clerk of court and the jury manager, which would mean just taking care of their everyday needs and making sure that they're adhering to court rules and that stuff. Did she have improper communications outside of that scope that's outlined in her official duties? Once that's settled, which I think it's, again, that ship has sailed, they have to say, okay, did it result in prejudice? Did it result in bias to the jury? And the defense, Harpootlian and Griffin, they're going all the way and saying it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because there's case law precedent.
The Cameron case, it
doesn't matter. Any improper contact necessarily biases the jury, it prejudices the jury, and we have to have a retrial.
You've got to have a fair trial.
That's their argument. Yeah. Now the state is still no.
Doing the green.
We need, and then there here comes the defense coming back. Said, okay, well, guess what? Not only now, if we apply that standard, the ball now shifts to your court. We think it's the state's now. It's now the state's responsibility to prove that there was no bias. Usually, it works the other way, right? The one who's making the accusation has to bring the proof. In general logic games, if I accuse you of something, I've got to come with the evidence. Part of Jim and Dick's filing this week was like, you know what? You have to prove that there wasn't. Jury bias and jury prejudice.
Based on these sworn affidavits of what they said?
And that's still something else that Justice Toll's going to have to...
Yeah, and I think a fair reading of these cases is that both sides have support for their positions. Mm-hmm. Okay. And she'll have to sort that one out as to what the standard is. That, to me, is going to be probably the central ruling, ironically, in all of the Murdoch sagas, her ruling on what the standard is.
The other thing is that I think we could be looking at more bombshells coming out of this as well. I mean, now that we've talked about the nuances, we've talked about, like, you know, maybe what's being read in these, you know, interviews, maybe there's more to it contextually. There is an opportunity. This is my question, actually. Is there an opportunity for the defense to give them more ammunition?
Good point.
Is there stuff they could be holding back, a few cards we haven't seen?
Obviously what's happened here is there's an agreement on discovery, and there's this very elaborate protective order. So all of the information that the state has gleaned relative to possible jury tampering, they're giving to the defense. They've asked the court to rule that the defense do likewise. I haven't heard a ruling on that in these pleadings. But even as we speak, I'm sure both sides are fast and furious, running down leads, checking things. So you're right. There could well be some very important new developments before we actually have a hearing.
Yeah. I'm just sitting here thinking, how much of what we have said here today and how much of what we've postulated and speculated and tried to suss out in our own brains, how much of what we've said here and ground covered is going to be just blown out of the water, irrelevant, completely landscape shifted in a month's time after these hearings and everything that comes out, and what new is out there.
The other thing is fascinating too, how Justice Toll has now, everything's in Richland County, which mm-hmm. to those that are unfamiliar, that's Columbia is the capital of South Carolina. That county is Richland. This trial had been in Colleton County, which is towards the coast of South Carolina in Colleton. And she has ruled that all the filings and everything be housed in Columbia with the Supreme Court. Everything's been moved out. And so the clerk is not involved with really anything as we go forward here at this point.
Necessary, I think, very much. I mean, if you're trying to keep proper, if you're trying to be proper and ethical, I think that was very much necessary. I do want a small correction because I had to correct myself there. That was Chief Justice Beatty who ordered that, not Toll herself.
I
got that wrong too, and had to go back. Someone pointed out to me that I didn't. You know, I didn't read all the way to the end of the actual line to see who
signed
it.
She didn't sign it.
Yeah, he signed it.
That's interesting
too. It was from him saying that all of the, and this, what we're talking about here is the case management, basically. The reason we had the murder trial in Colleton County is because that's where the murders happen. Colleton County, South Carolina. Therefore, it is the court system, where the venue where it's supposed to. And now that.
Yeah, and she picked, what I thought was, as I recall, the order giving her authority in this case gave her sort of a carte blanche. Yeah. She decided she's a Columbia person, AGs are Columbia people, mm-hmm. the defense are Columbia people. Alec, I guess, is a different county.
He's in a different county. The jurors are in a different county,
yeah,
too, which is, I thought that was going to play a big role as to where they wanted to do this, because the jurors are going to have to travel
right. Yeah.
to do this. But I guess if they're going to keep it within 3 days, it's a reasonable amount of time. And it's not that far, right?
Right.
I mean, to get from Walterboro to, how far is Walterboro to?
You can reasonably make it in an hour and a half if you're driving the speed limit.
Yeah. It's very convenient for the lawyers.
Take the back way up through Orangeburg and up 21, and you're there in no time.
Does this mean they have everything? Sorry, does this mean that going forward, everything has to stay in Richland County now? Like a retrial, if we have a retrial?
Oh, no. I think constitutionally he'd be entitled to the county of venue, I believe. So that would be another issue, but I just thought for right now.
For the evidentiary here.
Yeah, that's what's going on here.
Again, this is the case management, a lot of the case management itself. And yes, they're obviously having these hearings up there, but the case management is running through the Supreme Court.
That's actually a good point. If there's a retrial, I'm assuming they won't have the clerk of the Supreme Court down in Walterboro, but might be. That may be the way it works out.
Yeah, we're so far afield ahead of ourselves.
I know, of course.
With that potential retrial.
Yeah. I mean, we've just gotten thrown so many curveballs. I mean, I'm not surprised. We probably have some level of every time we turn around, there has been at least one more development in this case that you couldn't expect it to happen.
I know. And even today, the emails issue is still ongoing, and the corruption probe involving Becky. There's still a lot to go forward there, and I can expand on something that just to kind of pick up where we left off the last time that we were all together. I was saying that I was had been reliably informed based on developments in that investigation into the public corruption probe that at some point after Colleton County officials had immediately after Colleton County officials discovered there was wiretapping going on involving Becky Hill's son, Jeff Hill, the county's director of technology. Immediately after that, Becky's phone, her phone line, basically, was taken off the county's taxpayer-funded phone plan. It was transferred, like her phone number was taken off and put back into her control. Since then, I have learned that when her phone was subpoenaed, seized, search warranted, I don't know exactly the best way to phrase that, but more or less when investigators, state investigators looking into the wiretapping and public corruption allegations against her son, Jeff Hill, I also reported that they took Becky's phone. Well, I'm told the phone that ended up in Sled's hands was not the phone that Becky had been using to conduct county business, which is just a whole like level of whoa. So there's that speaks to, okay, something stinks in the state of Denmark, to poorly quote Shakespeare there. That again,
really,
it was the wrong phone. The investigators know it was the wrong phone. Adding on to that, Fitz News today, Wolf Oaks, the publisher of that online news outlet and commentary outlet, they published a pretty extensive report expanding on that today, that confirms not only what I'm saying there about she turned in the wrong phone. They go on to say the same thing happened with Jeff Hill with his phone. They're sort of painting the picture for potential obstruction charges in the corruption probe involving Jeff and Becky Hill, to the point that there's belief that the phones weren't not just, they didn't just disappear, they were destroyed, that they were originally using. Right. And that's citing Fitz News on that. So it's...
By the way, I should mention, because I was intrigued by the wiretapping charge, because when I think of wiretapping, I think of, you know, somebody tapping into a phone line and listening on the head. I actually looked at that statute, and I think it's called the Homeland Security Act. It's a very broad-based statute that mm-hmm. was passed, a few years ago. But it does list within there prohibitive acts, which would be, which could be covered by it, which apparently they're alleging, that he, in effect, used his position to intercept phone communications, as I recall.
Yeah, not just phone, emails.
Emails. That would be covered by the act.
So he would just be able to tap into their email system and be able to read whatever was going on.
He was the technology director.
Yeah.
So when you go through his computer, can you see can you see the emails that he allegedly confiscated or intercepted? Would you be able to see it like the way we FOIA'd for the 2,100 emails? Mm-hmm. We would be able to see what Jeff Hill was emailing. Yeah. I guess that's already with Sled.
Yeah. It's the same. The digital footprint. Everything you do in a digital ecosystem leaves a trail. A digital paper trail.
Take anything away from this. Take that.
You can try to cover your tracks to an extent, and you can reset devices and try and wipe data, but as far as servers that are out there, there's going to be some record of what you did at what time and the metadata. And we got into all of that during the Murdoch trial with the phones and how your phones aren't just tracking you, they're tracking movements, this thing, that thing, over here, over there. It's everything is logged for a period of time. With digital devices, and they can retrace your steps. But when you have access to something like that, you can do some pretty. If you're not scrupulous, you can do some pretty nefarious things when you have access to stuff like that. Which is, I think, what we're getting at the heart of with these wiretapping allegations. More to come on that we'll see in the meantime. I don't know when that's going to happen, but we undoubtedly it'll be at Friday on a 3 o'clock, Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, right when we're about ready to go home and call it a week.
So that's where we stand right now. We've got a lot to think about. We may have a few more briefs, right? As you were saying, they need to make sure that all this discovery goes through. We've got to make sure that all the everything has to be lined up before the 16th. And I have a feeling on the 16th at this conference status hearing, we're going to get a lot more clarification.
I would think as we go along, there'll be a lot of developments from the legal side. The factual investigation will go on. I wouldn't be surprised a lot more filings. But I do think, knowing Justice Toll, I feel like on the 16th, there's going to be some real ground rules set. We'll have an idea of what to expect. And I do think the setting aside of 3 days, that tells me it's a fairly involved situation.
And she wants to make sure that before she gets into that courtroom on the 29th, everybody knows what's going to be taking place.
I think that's the intent here, the way it's been set up, just time-wise and procedurally-wise. And it looks like sort of a, I hate to put it this way, but a bit of a Murdoch reunion, right? There'll be all the media
Absolutely. Folks,
reserve seating, the pool camera, the photographers, and really, I suspect, continued national, international interest.
Yeah, and they're expecting it as well. And that's something this time, you know, we've already been through an enormous amount of coverage on this. So, yes, we have a lot to be coming at the same time as when the murder trial was.
I don't think the TV will be as good, don't you think, though? I don't think the TV will be probably a lot less interesting because probably a lot will happen in camera.
Yeah.
And there'll be lots of legal arguments. But there still should be some, if Clerk Hill actually testifies, that would be sort of must-see TV, right? If that should be, if she actually testifies and goes through cross-examination.
During the trial, we had access to the in-camera hearings. Only the jury did not.
That's right. Well, this time, the in-camera is going to mean something different, I think. I think the in-camera this time is going to mean that we're going to be in the chambers with the justice.
Good point.
But to that point that Sam Griswold is our brilliant photographer who is helping us with our podcast, who you might have just heard on there, Sam's asking, why aren't we going to be able to see the in-camera like we did last time? The chambers, I am told that the testimony will be available to us after the fact.
Transcript.
It's not the transcripts, yes, or the, sorry. Mm-hmm. The transcripts should be available to us, and they shouldn't take that long. This is a 3-day hearing.
Mm-hmm, right.
So we're hoping to be able to see and hear what they heard back in those chambers.
Good point.
There's no reason why that should be sealed, right?
Point. Yeah, the order did say that would be available with the personal information. Actually, the defense was asking. But that was also remarkable to me, because apparently during that phone conversation, they had a lot of agreement. So the defense was proposing these things that looks like the state was comfortable with, in camera with jurors and transcripts afterwards with personal information being redacted.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good procedure, I think.
I think so, too. I think they certainly see what can happen to these personal lives when they are thrown into the center of these storms from all of the all the media coverage. You just can't deny it. And, you know, to that point, I think Clerk Hill has an opportunity here to do what she said she wanted to do since September, which was to clear her name to some degree.
That's very true.
So let's see.
Yeah, she may have,
you know,
really good answers to all these things that have been thrown at her.
She actually wrote about it in the emails. That's where I'm kind of thinking about is that we saw in the emails, Clerk Hill went on about, you know, this wasn't, I never did anything that I was, you know, basically ashamed of. Everything I did was on the up and up. So here's your opportunity to clear her name as much as she possibly can, and we'll see if she takes that opportunity.
Good point.
Or not.
Yeah.
So to be continued, of course. January 16th, we will be into this preliminary hearing, the status conference for what's going to be happening on January 29th, which is the retrial hearing, the evidentiary hearing. We will be there. We'll be covering it. You'll have your team here on top of it. And, of course, if anything happens between now and the 16th, which you know it will. We will certainly be covering that as well. So for now, thanks so much for joining us on Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs, Murders, Money, and Mystery with Charlie Kahn and Drew Tripp. Sam Griswold, thanks for the commentary at the end as well. And we will be back with you soon.